Rod's Pulse Podcast number 18, Web 2.0 and Open Education, plus PodSafe Mozart. Hi, I'm Rod Murray, and this is Rod's Pulse Podcast, the podcast for faculty and students interested in learning how to use and create podcasts and other e-learning technologies. Welcome back to another podcast. That's a bit of Mozart's Concerto for Flute and Harp in C Major. I'll play the full movement at the end of this podcast. First, I have one news item for you today. Jefferson just announced the availability of Blackboard Backpack for Pulse. Now, Pulse is Jefferson's brand for Blackboard. This new feature will allow students, and for that matter, faculty and staff, to download all of their content from Blackboard to a laptop, or tablet PC, or desktop PC for that matter. Backpack supports creating annotations and notes on course documents along with highlighting, searching, and a lot of other features. So you can sync up your laptop and work offline when you're not conveniently attached to an internet connection. It's an application that needs to be installed on your laptop and costs about $49. Blackboard currently offers a 30-day free trial, so you can see if this product is helpful, and then you can try it before you buy it. I hope to have an interview with the creators of Backpack in an upcoming episode, so stay tuned. For more information, you can go to the Blackboard Backpack website at backpack.blackboard.com. Now for my main topic today, I want to share with you a wonderful podcast lecture about what might be called Web 2.0 and open education. I've been podcasting about educational uses of the internet, including blogging, wikis, and of course podcasting. And I think I also mentioned some social software called Second Life. If you have children, you probably also heard of MySpace. Can all of these Web 2.0 technologies transform education in a way that television was supposed to, but never did? First, you might ask, what is Web 2.0? First of all, I guess it's not the second iteration of a Microsoft software product, but it's a natural evolution of the World Wide Web. Web 2.0 has been called the two-way web, or the read-write web, and it's enabled by the convergence of widespread access to existing knowledge, I guess that would be Web 1.0, together with a widespread ability to publish new knowledge, witness blogs, wikis, and podcasts. There was a persuasive analysis of how these trends can improve education. It comes from Dr. John Wilinski, who I discovered on John Udell's blog. John Udell writes a column for InfoWorld magazine, which I often read. I'll have a link to John Udell's blog on my blog. Now, Dr. John Wilinski was a keynote speaker at a recent event. It was the second annual learning conference at the University of British Columbia, subtitled Learning Free of Boundaries. The conference opened with a keynote address by Dr. Wilinski. First, a brief bio. Quote, John Wilinski is currently the Pacific Press Professor of Literacy and Technology and Distinguished University Scholar in the Department of Language and Literacy Education at the University of British Columbia, as well as a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. His most recent book, The Access Principle, The Case for Open Access to Research and Scholarship, from MIT Press in 2006, has won the Blackwell Scholarship Award from the American Library Association. Examples of his work, including the open source software designed to improve access and quality of research, are available at the Public Knowledge Project, which he directs at the University of British Columbia. And again, I'll give the URL for that, end quote. Anyway, Dr. Wilinski's keynote talk was called a newly open and public quality to learning. And again, I'm quoting from the website. Quote, his presentation reviews the educational developments in the public sphere that are taking place outside of the classroom settings, which include open access to scholarship, the Wikipedia cooperative knowledge movement, the democratic pursuits of the blogosphere, the open source software movement, and the health information revolution. The pedagogical implication of these movements for educators and researchers were considered in terms of fostering new lessons on the circulation of knowledge, the intellectual properties of our work, and the prospects of a more deliberative democracy, end quote. Again, please see my blog for a direct link to these materials, including the full hour-long lecture by Dr. Walensky. It's something you don't want to miss. So first, let's hear a bit about what he says about the health information revolution. Walensky talks about how patients with little ability to read specialized medical literature are doing just that. Now, I know from my own experience, my father, even in his late 80s, would arrive in his doctor's office with a stack of printouts from the web, and he would ask some very well-informed questions. Let's listen to this clip from Walensky's keynote.
And I just thank my stars that in 1997 I hadn't declared, well, one thing we don't have to worry about is the public reading medical research, because the public with a grade 7.8, or 7.3 in some instances, a grade 7.8 reading level would not be able to handle medical research, which is at 14.3 to 14.9. So we don't have to worry about any problems such as public picking up this work, taking it into a doctor's office, throwing it on the doctor's desk, and asking why my daughter is not receiving this treatment. That's just not going to happen because we have a good 7 or 8 year reading gap there. Thank heavens I didn't say that in public, because I would have had to resign. That would have been it for my career, because I was proven entirely dead wrong. The public has taken up this research that they have no right to be reading and no ability or capacity to make sense of. And they are throwing it down on doctors' desks, and they are asking doctors why, how, when is this going to happen? And the doctor's first thought was, I should sue Walensky. He so set me up for this. I did not see this coming. And then the second thing they did is they phoned the Canadian Medical and American Medical Association and said, what are we going to do about this? I'm being intimidated by patients bringing in research. I'm spending my time explaining to patients why they're misreading the symptoms and why their case is a little bit different, and I'm having to get into a whole explanation of what I don't know and what they do know and what I'm learning and what they are showing me. And the American Medical Association, Canadian Medical Association, let's not call it patient intimidation. I don't think that would be wise. Let's not sue our patients for libel. Let's call it, wait, call back. And we did, and they did call back. And the AMA and the CMA said, let's call it shared decision making. And I'm not kidding you. I'm not making this up. The American Medical Association is now calling it shared decision making, that patients are bringing in information and they are discussing it. One physician I talked to did say, actually technically, and this is a medical term, John, we call it a time suck. Because we're spending our time explaining to people. We are having this, and I'm saying to them, excuse me, we call that in my business an educational moment. A teachable opportunity, a teachable moment. And they're saying, well, but I have to read book. So, if I could just pause for a moment here and bring you back to the question at hand, and that is, the public has established a different kind of expectation towards learning. If someone in their family is not well, they say, I need to know about this. They don't say, let's make an appointment. They say, I'm going online. How many are going online? You're asking me that. You pretend to be a social scientist? 7 million every day in the United States, where we have these figures from, we don't from Canada, 7 million a day are going online.
Now let's listen to Dr. Walensky talk about independent learning and access to knowledge.
We've always talked about independent learning, and we've always talked about, you know, that kind of sense, we want to create independent critical thinkers. But there is a whole new relationship to the access to knowledge. And what we need to speak to is that expectation. And when we give students textbooks, we are not speaking to that expectation. When that textbook is wrapped up in 15 pounds of paper, in $185 worth of text, and it contains the whole of the subject, and you give it to the student, and that student sells it at the end of the term to the next student for 2 years until the next edition comes out so that you're in cahoots with the publisher to ensure that the used market doesn't undermine their profits or hurt their shareholder value, you are taking an entirely archaic and disabling approach to access to knowledge, because it suggests that it comes in a package, you work with it for three months, I say 6 months, you're teaching courses 6 months, for 3 months and a week, and then it goes away, and you're done, and you move on. And there's no engagement with that larger world of knowledge. And that's what I want to address and speak to.
Okay, here he talks about Wikipedia and why people would construct knowledge without getting paid.
1,500 new articles a day last August in one measure. 1,500 new articles being added. And what are these people getting out of it? I don't understand. Why would they do this? They're not getting any marks. No university credits. Why would people construct knowledge on that basis? And we can smile. Truth is, I don't have an answer, which is embarrassing. Because I'm an educator, and I believe in the value of people learning for marks. I think knowledge is a valuable thing when you're getting credit, or when you're being paid to share it with other people, or given lovely hotel rooms overlooking Lake Okanagan. Yes, then there is that value. So this is a weird educational phenomenon that we have to get on hold of. We have to become part of. And so the wiki as one aspect, and the wiki is more popular now than the New York Times, and as a website, it's the 37th, and I don't even want to know the first 15, but the 37th most popular website for people. People are going to the encyclopedia? Like that? It's amazing. Now you're saying to me, hey, it's not very accurate. I found a mistake in the Wikipedia.
Now he goes on to say that he quoted a study that compared Encyclopedia Britannica with Wikipedia, and it showed that for every 3 errors in Encyclopedia Britannica, Wikipedia had about 4. It doesn't sound too bad to me. Okay, here he discusses how learning is nothing unless it's a contribution to others.
There will be no time in their life when they are more dedicated to acquiring and organizing and evaluating knowledge. What better time? Why don't we start to build, as it were, that expectation, that habit of contributing, that learning is nothing unless it's a contribution to others, that we have so individualized and privatized, we're so wrapped up in exam booklets where you demonstrate your learning in a way that has no value. I don't know about you, I'm not keeping all my exam booklets from previous years. And so there is a kind of disconnect between what we do with learning in the university and what people are doing for nothing in the world. And we need to rethink that kind of connection.
Here's one last clip. It may be a surprise to many of you, but he claims that if you publish in open access journals, you may get an order of magnitude or more citations.
So as authors among you, and those of you talking to researchers and authors, I want to give you just one piece of advice. You don't need to publish in an open access journal, but you might think about it. There are 2,000 open access journals, which are completely free online, listed in the University of Lund's directory of open access journals. And I hope that the library here as a guide to the DOAJ, the Directory of Open Access Journals, so you can check. You can publish in one of those. Your work is immediately available for free, but you don't need to. You can publish in Elsevier, the most expensive. But you need to take advantage of the archiving potential. And you need to find a way to put it on your own website or to say to the librarian, I want this up. And why would you do that? Pure, unadulterated self-interest. That's why you would do it. Forget this humanity, right to know stuff. It will do something for your career. Let me just tell you what happens if you put your articles up. You publish it in Elsevier, you're guaranteed 600, 1,000 readers. You put it up on the web, and you're guaranteed 20,000 readers. How do we know this? We've done the research. I'm a social scientist. You can trust me. What does it look like in terms of percentages? It's not so good in philosophy. Do we have anybody in philosophy? Yes, it's about a 50% increase in citations. I know, but you can become 50% more famous. Do we have any physicists here? Okay, look at this, how well the room, these are all plants. Physics, you could become entirely famous. About 250% increase in citations. You could be 250% more famous than anyone else at the east end, west end of the campus or the east end of the campus if you make your work open access, no matter where you publish it. Physical letters A, physical letters B, put it up on the web. 250% increase in citations. Okay? The world is yours. It's a limited time offer. Well, I mean, figure it out. If everybody's open access, you don't get any advantage.
So anyway, I hope these tidbits from Dr. Walensky's talk will entice you to listen to his full 60-minute lecture. I think it'll be time well spent. In addition to, of course, his thoughtful content, he's certainly a master lecturer. He gives educational credibility to wikis and blogs, and by extension, I think, podcasts. And, of course, his podcast, his lecture, being a prime example of the power of the human voice. So you can find the URL on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. Now for some more PodSafe music to round out your commute or your exercise session or lunch hour or however you are listening to this. So before I sign off, I thought you might like to hear the entire second movement for Mozart's Concerto for Flute and Harp in C Major by the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra. If you recall, I played the first movement at the end of RPP number 13. The full CD is entitled Mozart Orchestral Works, and it's available at magnatune.com. That about does it for today's program. Thanks very much for listening. Please don't forget to leave me feedback. You can go to rodspulsepodcast.com and leave comments on my blog. You can send feedback to my email address, rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. You can also send me audio feedback by calling into my comment line at 610-616-2199. Till next time, have a great week.